Welcome, everyone. I'm James Littrell. I'm your guest host today on Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And it's my pleasure to have with us today, Reid Bunzel. Reid has a new thriller out that I think you're all going to want to take a look at. And before we get to chatting about the new book, which is absolutely fantastic and comes out tomorrow. So this is release week. It's fresh off the presses and you'll want to go check it out. But for those of you who don't know Reid, Reid is writing this book as Hilton Reid, and he's the author of 10 crime novels and thrillers, as well as several nonfiction books. A former media industry executive, he served as editor-in-chief for United News and Media's San Francisco publishing operations. And earlier in his career, he was an editor-in-chief of Streamlines Publishing, Radio Inc., and Streaming Magazines. He previously was an editor at both Radio Records and Broadcasting Magazine, and he served in an executive capacity at the National Association of Broadcasters and the Radio Advertising Bureau. He's a graduate of Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, and he holds a degree in anthropology, cum laude. We're going to try to talk about that a little bit later, too. He's a native of the San Francisco Bay Area, and he currently resides with his wife, Diana, in Charleston, South Carolina. So welcome, Reid. Good to see you again.
Thank you, James. Always good to see you. I really appreciate it. And I have to say, I love that musical bumper. That's a nice little catchy jingle there. So
it is. I wish I could claim credit to it, but that's all Pam Stack who does it.
I know.
But the work still, behind the boards
it's
here.
It's a nice catchy little tune.
It is. It's fun. So yeah, you've got a brand new thriller coming out, Beyond All Doubt. Let me get a good picture of this for folks. And could you tell us a little bit about the story in Beyond All Doubt? It's really kind of an intriguing one.
Absolutely. And this book has gone through so many different metamorphoses from when it first popped into my head some time ago, and it just lingered there. Sometimes I'll write a book real fast. Sometimes it kind of writes itself in my head. And this is one of those. And it actually goes back, I think, to maybe 15 years ago when it first germinated in my head. At that point, it was titled American Rendition. And if you remember, we were in the Iraq War at the time, and there were these things called renditions, supposedly, where U.S. forces would supposedly kidnap somebody and take them to a black ops site and then interrogate them, or that person would just disappear. And it conjured up this idea in my mind of what would happen if a guy, because I write usually, although not always, from a male point of view, what would happen if his wife just suddenly disappeared, or if his wife died and he didn't know, and he was fed this, this conjecture of what had happened. And so it just, it festered and festered, and sometime 7 or 8 years ago, I started putting it down on paper, and it went through a number of different scenarios, many different titles, as well as the whole thing really came together. I started writing it as third person multiple and realized that I couldn't do the things with that I wanted. So I turned it to third person singular, and even that didn't work. So I thought, I want it to come from me. I want it to sound as if I'm the narrator, as if I am that character. And so it switched to first person, and then it just really took off. And I enjoyed writing it immensely. It probably went through 15 or 20 different major drafts. I had a number of different beta readers look at it, other editors. It was one that I just really wanted to fine tune and hone down until it was as fast paced as I could possibly make it.
Wow. That's an amazing story of how that came together. So
all my books usually do that, but this one did. And I just let it do its thing until it was ready to come out.
Just let it ferment for a little bit.
That's right. And then like here a good it is. Wine.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now your main character, Cameron Kane, he's a great character, by the way. I think you really did a good job, putting him on the page. You know, when we open up the book, we find him in a kind of a difficult place in his life anyway. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that and how maybe that came to be as part of the story?
Well, sure. And again, just like the book itself, the character evolved somewhat over time, but the character always from the very beginning was a recent widower. and had a young daughter. And I write that partially from personal experience, because many years ago, I lost my first wife, not under the same circumstances as in this book, but I've been there. And so I know the difficulty of trying to resurrect your life and rebuild and cobble things together again. So that was, you know, very heartfelt and very honest to me. But the character of Cameron Cain, he lives in New York. He had a previous career sort of as a globetrotting AP journalist, photojournalist. And because of marriage and family commitment, he's a little bit more sedentary. And I think is living somewhat of a mundane life until he's offered an opportunity possibly to change that after his wife passes away. But he also has responsibility for his daughter that he's raising as a single dad. And I really wanted to give him some depth of character and also this opportunity for him to grow again, to rebuild and you know, take over his own life once more after passing through all the grief and sadness. And so he's at that stage, and on the very first page, you know, he's coming back from an opportunity an interview for an opportunity on the other coast in California, not sure what he really wants to do. And bam, all of a sudden he's hit with a reality, or what he perceives to be a reality, about what really might have happened or might not have happened to his late wife. And the future against the past, as well as his daughter's future and past, and the truth as he thinks it may be, but isn't quite sure. And he's got people around him telling him, you know, Cameron, you're nuts. So I wanted to have all of these different characters in there so that there's a psychological, element there, that conflict going on in his mind of whether he's nuts, whether he's not nuts, and just what to do with all of this. And meantime, and not to give away any spoilers, there's a young woman who's very much interested in him, and he's very much interested in her. And so he doesn't know what to make of that as well.
Yeah, I think the way you captured the emotions, you know, between Cameron and his daughter, and even the new woman that's kind of come into his life, I thought they were really, you know, heartfelt. They felt real. And it was just really well done. And you touched on something about, you know, people are telling him, you know, what to believe. And there's kind of some subtle gaslighting going along with, at Cameron. And mm-hmm. how did you come up with the inspiration for that kind of a gaslighting approach for your character?
Well, I could answer that question in several ways, and maybe I will. But first of all, with the characters who are close to him, I don't know that it's necessarily gaslighting as much as it is just really caring about him and wanting to warn him that he's going off on this on this gravelly path through the woods, and you don't know what's down that path, and you know it's not like. That's not the path less taken that you want to go, is what the people close to him are saying. But on the other hand, there are some other folks out there who are protecting. I'm trying not to give away too much. I don't want to do any spoilers. But and actually, that is one of the aspects that worked into the way that I wrote it, is because, and one of the reasons, as I stated earlier, I shifted from third person multiple to first person, because there are certain things that I wanted to allude to, but I didn't want to give away. And third person multiple would have given away a lot too much. And so it was a conscious effort not to do that. And that's why the first person, I think, works really well. And told from Cameron Cain's point of view, you don't know if the people who are gaslighting him are gaslighting him, or if the truth is stranger than fiction or the truth here, whether they're being honest, whether they're being dishonest, and whom to believe and whom not to believe. And as I recreated this book in first person, that's what gave me the opportunity to introduce some of that gaslighting and some of those unknown or unresolved issues that I hope get resolved as the book goes on. And there, I also think there's a major twist or two in here where all of a sudden it's like, oh, and you begin to realize that gaslighting is going on, and even much more than that, downright deception.
Yeah, exactly that. And it, again, I thought it was really well done. And yeah, this, I'm just going to show the book again because it's got a great cover, great story. Yeah, it comes out tomorrow, mm-hmm. so it's perfect timing. How has your background as a journalist informed how you write a thriller?
I have one real clear-cut answer to that, but there's other aspects as well. As a journalist, one of the things that I really enjoyed doing the most, and my journalism career took place mostly in the entertainment business, largely in the early days, radio and music, and then branched off into internet and streaming and that sort of thing. But I really enjoyed doing Q&A interviews, much more than I enjoyed reading them. And back then it was not streaming or podcasts, it was printed page Q&A. And I interviewed a lot of, in my mind, interesting folks, some major celebrity types, some that you know, just business people that were in the media business at the time. But what it got me to do when I would read so many Q&A interviews that were just so stilted, and they never did any editing. The editors never did, or the interviewer did, and. So what I did, I took liberty with what I got on the tape recorder and turned it into conversation so that it wasn't just me asking a question and then the person responding. It would be like a conversation that you would read in a book. And to me, dialogue is so critical. And whenever I have an opportunity, I try to take descriptive prose and find an opportunity to have at least two people discussing it so that there isn't just a lot of words on the page, so that instead there's a lot of dialogue. And I really believe by doing all these interviews, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews, and then editing them down, I was able to really sharpen the dialogue in my books and understand that this character speaks this way and this character speaks this way. And a character may not absolutely answer a question. They may deflect. They may, they may just totally avoid. They may lie. All sorts of different things, and that's all happened to me in the journalism career. And so then the protagonist, which usually would be the one me asking the question, has to come back and draw that person back around. And so by learning that and by just experiencing it over decades worth of work. I really think that it helped on the dialogue side, which to me is one of the most critical elements of writing a book. That's why I always loved Elmore Leonard so well, because he just nailed it. And as he would say, leave out the parts that no one wants to read, but the dialogue is what everybody always wants to read. And so that's sort of my first rule of writing.
No, I agree. You can reveal so much about a character through dialogue, and you do that. In your books.
Thank you.
kind of on the same theme, how did your degree in anthropology factor into becoming a crime writer?
That it's, again, I find it an interesting question and something that I don't usually talk about because I don't know if other people find it as interesting as I do. When I was in college, I grew up loving two things, writing and radio. And I went to a small liberal arts college in Maine, as you mentioned in the beginning. And with a liberal arts education, they didn't have things like a journalism track or this or that or the other thing. So I experimented with a lot of things. I've always been interested in societal issues and history of humankind, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And really was fascinated by anthropology and all of the different aspects that go into it, whether it's religion or physical anthropology or archaeology or social things, whether it's historical or contemporary or any of those elements. But what where anthropology really kind of worked into my career was I started calling myself a media anthropologist, because media is the way that we communicate with each other today. It always has been, whether it's cave writings or smoke signals or early writings, just writing things down, and then the printing press, whatever, and then later, of course, radio and television, et cetera, et cetera. But to me, media is an important aspect of society, and so it allowed me not only to talk about when I was writing about different aspects of communication, but also to learn those aspects of communication and again refine it down into my writing and editing at the time, and then bring it to the front in the books that I've written, whether they're the nonfiction books or primarily the mysteries and crime novels and thrillers that I've written, because I think in all of that, there's always, in a crime novel or a mystery, there's always a criminal, if not many more than one, and there's somebody trying to solve it or trying to deal with it, trying to work their way through it. And again, that's that communicative aspect of media anthropology. And so to me, it was a great fit. I kind of look at it as kind of creating my own niche from something that when I graduated, everybody I knew said, anthropology? What are you going to do with that? You going to teach anthropology? No. But I was able to use it as the backbone of the career that I was able to, end up falling into and love it.
That's great. No, that's really interesting. I love it. Now you've written, 10 novels. Mm-hmm. So you've been in the business for a while. You've seen what it's like from the inside. What kind of advice would you give to new and aspiring authors that are just thinking about jumping into the crime fiction business?
Really good question. And it's one that I have been asked, before. And I think a lot of writers are, especially if you go to conferences or if you're approached at a book signing, or even as a lot of us have done, talked to in schools and that sort of thing. And I don't think I've got a really profound answer other than read and write. And I was read to as a young kid, and I think that instilled in me a love of books. I, as soon as I could, I was reading chapter books on my own. I have to admit, I preferred reading rather than being read to, because I would be my own inner voice that I would see and hear. But I have to thank my parents, especially my mother, for just incessantly reading to me. I had a really good third grade teacher. My next book is dedicated to him, a fellow named Tom Hamill. Couldn't have done more to instill in me a love of reading and a love of writing. He was a children's illustrator and a writer of his own, and had won a number of awards. And so all of these things kind of instilled in me the love of reading and writing. But to get to the core of your question, if you don't find time to write, you won't be a writer. And I think that's where it really, cuts to the core, is if you keep on sharpening pencils or find reasons to not sit down and actually write. And you could, I wrote my first draft on a yellow legal pad. So you don't need to have a typewriter with white ink or anything else. You just need to sit down, find the time, make the time, and put words on paper. And they can be as awful as they're probably going to be, especially in that first draft. You need to just do it just do it every day, or 5 or 6 days a week. I know it's tough, especially if you've got a job, if you've got kids, if you have all of the the normal obligations and responsibilities of everyday family life. You still have to find that time, whether it's to get up an hour early or to not watch television at night. That was the way I ended up writing my first book, was just not watch television. Didn't harm me in the slightest, I don't think.
We met with a group of authors yesterday for a writer's coffee house meeting, and same subject, you know, making writing that time a priority in your life. If that's what you want to do, then it's got to be a priority. So I think, you know, that's good advice, Breed.
Well, thank you. And one other thing, you don't have to be the best writer in the world either. I have no idea how I rank in there, but I know that writing was a major part of my career. But if it isn't, if you come from a different walk of life, don't worry about that. As long as you can put together a phenomenal story and dialogue and description and setting and plot and all of these things, that's why they have these people called editors.
Yes.
And a good editor will find a good story, even if it means like a diamond kind of chiseling it out of that bedrock and doing the cuts that need to be done. You don't have to, just don't run away or even walk away if you feel your writing isn't good enough.
I agree. You mentioned, you know, you're working on the next book. So what is coming next from you, Reed?
I have a sequel to a thriller that came out last year. The one that came out last year is titled Greenwich Mean Time. And it involves and this may sound trite, but a world-class assassin who has an extra paranormal talent that makes him the most dangerous man alive. And where I came up with the idea for that one was I thought, you know, I like superheroes, but I'm not into Marvel. I wanted a superhero who actually is human, but has a superpower that that he has no ability to control, although he has every ability in the world to use it. And so that one was titled Greenwich Mean Time. And I have a sequel to that coming up in the fall called The Fall of Vivaldi. My mother just loved Vivaldi. And so I was raised with the music around at all times, and I knew sooner or later I would end up writing a book with Vivaldi in the title. But this is a spoiler alert. Vivaldi does not play a huge role in this book, but there is something called Vivaldi that does. And it involves several different character paths that interconnect through the movie and
hopefully movie.
The novel and bring it to a resolution. But there's a lot of different international aspects that are intertwined, from growing neo-fascism in Europe to sex trafficking you know, everything in between.
Very cool. Very cool, Reed.
Thank you.
We'll end up with what I call three quick hits, and that's three quick questions about Cameron Cain, your main character in your book. What's his favorite music?
His favorite music, I think, is sort of an alternative Americana type of thing, and mixed in with a little smooth jazz.
Okay, I could see that. Mm-hmm. How about what's Cameron's favorite cocktail?
Originally it was a martini, because I love martinis and I collect martini glasses, but he likes bourbon straight.
Got it. Okay. And then finally, what's Cameron's greatest fear?
Raising his daughter wrong, not having his late wife around, not having a mother around for his daughter, Sabrina.
I can absolutely see that in the book, in the story. So, folks, we've been talking with Reed Bunzel, whose writing is Hilton Reed in Beyond All Doubt. It's coming out this week, so you want to go out and snag it. And you can say that you know a media anthropologist. So, this is the way to do it. Reed, thanks. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Jay.
Wish you all the luck on the launch, and we'll be seeing you at some of the conferences down the road, I hope.
Absolutely, I'm planning on being there.
Good.
Hope to see you too.
Thank you. Thanks again, Reed.
Thank you.